and be forgotten forever. Therefore, in the great flat pattern of things, there is either something better or nothing. Whereas in this world, there is too much of something worse or nothing, or and nothing. So in this point, faith, as St. Paul points out, becomes a very important thing to us. It is the ability to live a good life, keep our principles, and practice the integrities we hold to be sacred. Most of us gathered here today are idealists. We believe in these principles. We believe in the integrities of life. But somewhere between the fulfillment of faith and our present frame of mind, there is a barrier. And that barrier is that the faith is held in one department of the mind, but fear governs another. The conflict between faith and fear in ourselves is tremendous. Also, the compromise by means of which we voluntarily sacrifice faith in order to improve the environment in which we live, this also is very important in our thinking. I know when people that we meet with and work with all the time are good people. They are kindly people. But for some reason, nearly all of them carry some mark of insufficiency. One is jealous and at the same time feels perfectly satisfied that he is profoundly religious. Another is a constant cynic, decrying, low-grading everything in his environment. He believes that he is an honest and noble soul, but he's having great trouble living with his own confusion. Another individual believes in truth, but he will defraud his tax returns without a moment of hesitation, because these things are open to violation because he does not believe in them. What he does not believe in them, he feels no duty to obey them. All of these situations constitute a problem in life that we all face. We all have the heel of Achilles somewhere. We are none of us above the pressures and problems that bind us to the unfortunate consequences of our own decisions. But we can do something about it. We can gradually weed out the things that cause pain, and anything that causes pain to another is ultimately going to cause pain to us. Therefore, all vengeance and revenge is beyond the way of religion. Supposing we took every case of revenge out of existence, and no individual anymore was out to avenge some real or imaginary ill. One nation to avenge itself against another nation, and so on down through all the levels of society. If this didn't exist, and we really believed the words of Scripture, where it says, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay." If we turn these things back to the Lord, and just kind of slur that word a little bit, and say law, if we return these things to the eternal law, which is the will, a manifestation of the eternal power, they will solve themselves. But while we try to play God, we generally do not do as well as we would if we worked a little harder and became human beings. We just do not understand these problems. We can't. But we do know that there is a harmless life that we can live. That this harmless life may result in some sacrifices. It may destroy this tremendous pressure of success. But it will also, in all probability, if it becomes part of a way of life for large groups of people, will end forever poverty and religious conflicts and revolutions. We won't have millions of people dying from the evils of revenge or vengeance or dictatorship. If these motions and emotions were gradually subsiding within our own natures. Somewhere in the world, we have to come to what Gandhi so well mentioned, that there is nothing that can bind human beings together but the golden thread of love. The only answer to hate is love. The only answer to fear is faith. And faith involves love. For faith realizes that we are in the midst of a divinely ordained universe, miraculous beyond our wildest imagination, incredible beyond the estimation of any intellect alive today, and that all of this is part of something that could be very beautiful, that it is only our own selfishness and our own mistakes that keeps it from being a very beautiful and lovable place to be. And what happens if one person tries to live this and does not wish to become part of this conflict? Well, there are many things that happen. There may be a greater impulse to do a good job when working, that the individual is working not any longer simply for a paycheck and stretching the job as long as possible, but maybe like the Essenes of the Dead Sea and En-Gedi in the Holy Land. The Essenes were a community whose principal craft was building. They built houses and homes for the poor. They made very simple little houses, but they made no charge. Their charity was to see that the poor had roofs over their heads. Also, they engaged in no profit business. They accepted no interest rates. They lived very simply. Even their clothes were held in common. And what happened? Something very interesting. The Romans, while they were ruling the country, made these Essenes the guardians of their children. The Romans saw in these Essenes a virtue that he did not possess, but he hoped his children might sometime know. So here was the bitter, ambitious, militant Romans respecting above all this class of people who owned nothing, had no war, were never involved in crime, but who lived primarily to serve. The motto of the Prince of Wales, of course, as we know, is "I serve." It was also the last words of Kundry in the opera of Parsifal. Service takes the place of ambition. Service comes to be the joy of seeing that we are helping, the joy of bringing light and life to the eyes of sufferers. Life and these things constitute the good way, the way that we either have to cultivate or we will finally destroy ourselves. We must realize that under existing conditions, we are going to be faced with further population explosion. Maybe not as rapid as we have had, but this planet is going to gradually reach a condition of congestion that it will be suicide for anyone to hate anyone. We won't be able to exist in this condition. We must all gain a sense of brotherhood, of friendship, of kindness, and we must work for these ends. Almost everyone who has worked for them has been martyred or ridiculed. And yet in the after term of things, these martyrs have become the great heroes of the race. We know they were right, but we just do not know how to live as they did in the presence of the temptations that we face. So in these problems, we have to search for some kind of consolation. Millions of people every day pray. They do not know who they pray to, but they know that somewhere there is something that is greater than themselves. Also, in praying, perhaps they are always heard, because the eternal power that is in the furthermost is also in the innermost part of ourselves. Perhaps the God in us hears the prayer that comes up from our hearts and our minds. But whatever it is, if we form a union with bitterness and with virtue, we overcome much of the evil of selfishness and despair. Today, there are tremendous evils alive in the world. And most of these evils are associated not merely with these ambitions of a few warlords. They are part of a pattern which we are all using in the effort to profit, in the effort to become wealthy in our own right, to take over all the comforts and luxuries of living without realizing that this situation is short-sighted and bound in the end to result in a further revolution of slavery where it shows up. Therefore, faith is our best help. Faith is the realization, in a sense, that there is something important in every good thing that we do. That in some way, religion is a practice of the presence of God in all things. In business, in art, in music, we notice the deterioration that has set in which the individual is becoming hopelessly enslaved to sickness and crime. And yet, even as we pick up the paper, we see another group of delinquents in trouble. We see more of those who have lived badly, destroying themselves. We see evil habits destroying and taking away the pleasures of life. And those who might have had a long and happy and useful existence die in early years because of excesses of one kind or another. All of these things should mean something. They should tell us that there is a reason, a law that operates whether we can see it or not. That this law is inflexible. That this law will always operate. And it operates in every grain of sand. It operates in the smallest bug and the greatest creature. Everywhere, the wonder of existence reveals an absolute order. There is no way of avoiding the fact that even the tiniest drop of something is a universe of life. These things we know. We can see them. And modern science can show them to us again and again. But the thing that we must learn is that behind all of this, there has to be a purpose. There has to be something that does that which we see but do not understand. There has to be an infinite law. There are no mistakes. There are no changes in these patterns. The crimes of our ancestors are the same crimes we have today. They suffered and now we suffer. So all this tells us that there is a supreme power, an incredible, wonderful reality, and that in this reality there is reason, there is purpose, there is life, and that there's no place in this power for despair. There is only a great hope, and this hope is really a kind of faith, because this hope is supported by a tremendous amount of evidence that is almost always ignored. We see only a few little scientific nuts and bolts on a machine. We do not see the tremendous spread throughout the cosmos of something that has to be infinite, that has to be big enough to take care of all things, and yet, in some strange and wonderful way, this great and eternal bigness has to be also mindful of a sparrow's fall. There is nothing too small to be part of it, nothing so large that it can escape from it. This reality is eternal. Therefore, with this in mind, we can all be religious. We don't have to be sectarianly religious, although we can be. There's no problem there. But the problem of religion is that it gets into our hearts, gets into our souls, and makes us begin to conform with the great principles which we know to be true. We know these laws work, and yet in our daily life we are completely indifferent to them. We go on day after day exploiting each other, and each in turn is exploited by someone else. This is not what humanity was built for. We are magnificently equipped to dream, to hope, to aspire, to become something each day larger than we were the day before. And yet we waste all this in contention and in conflict, in argument and sophistry. So it would be very well to try to find out a little bit about the problem of faith. And I think perhaps one of the great examples of mysticism in faith was the German shoemaker, Jakob Behme. Mamie had very little education. He went to a small school in Görlitz where he learned his alphabet and did what most Germans of that industrial level did in those days, learn enough language so that he could read the Bible. He became apprenticed to a shoemaker. And then something happened. Something happened by means of which his eyes were opened. He suddenly saw a universe infinitely greater. Something happened. One account says that he had a pewter cup hanging on the wall of his room. And that one day, as he happened to glance up at the pewter cup, a ray of sun hit it and caused a tremendous burst of light right at that moment. And as he looked up into this ray of light, suddenly the universe opened. Something happened. Something he was never able to explain. But he suddenly realized that he was living in a universe of infinite love and infinite order. That all these things that we see physically are merely the visible shadows of invisible truth, of invisible truths. That all realities are invisible, but they are made visible through their consequences and through the study of their processes. He became a great mystic. He was by nature a Lutheran, and he attended Lutheran church every Sunday and always sat in the same pew. The minister, Richter, was an absolute misery. He was a sophist. He was an intolerant bigot. And he loved to rail at Behme because Behme was not sufficiently orthodox. And he insulted him every Sunday in church publicly. And each week, Behme went back and sat and listened. He made no effort to answer. Finally, once when he was in very much concern, he tried to call on the Parson Richter in the little parsonage. And when he came in the door, Richter took off his shoes and threw them at him. Behme carefully picked up the shoes and returned them to him. No word of criticism. Behme left a tremendous legacy. Because of his unorthodoxy as a Lutheran, the Lutherans refused to bury him in sanctified ground when he died. And along came a famous nobleman, an Orthodox Catholic, who happened to be one of the rulers of the province. And he said, bury him in sanctified ground where he belongs. So a non-Lutheran was responsible for Behme's funeral. All these things come down. There were many groups founded around the concepts of Behme. This concept of the universe of infinite life, this universe of infinite beauty, this tremendous machinery of causes, of which these effects that we see are but a tiny fragment. To keep this universe in its proper order and accomplish what is necessary to maintain it, we might almost say, as they would say in a case of military equipment, it would take 1,000 men in the background unnoticed to keep one man in the front-line trench. In the case of universal mysteries, it takes a whole order of life to make possible the fulfillment of one small pattern in human existence. Behind all of the different forms of life, infinite number of living things, birds, animals, infinite climates, lands and continents, all kinds of processes, there has to be somewhere a sovereign intelligence manifesting through a vast order of invisible intelligences. Now, we can deny this, of course. But what do we gain? We don't gain an explanation, because the only other explanation that anyone's ever advanced is that it's an accident. It doesn't mean anything. It just happened. This is very little consolation to anybody, and very difficult to prove if the truth were known. It is better, therefore, as Bacon said, to believe all the fables of the ancients than that this universal fabric is without a mind. Therefore, we are living in a living universe, and this makes possible the justification of faith. If everything is as it should be except ourselves, then it's time to get in line, to get in step with the realities of existence rather than to continue to battle for selfishness in a world that selfishness is not intended to have. So we find all these little patterns coming along from various sources of mysticism and so forth, many mystics. One of the great English mystics was William Law, who was a disciple, in a sense, of Behme. And out of the entire group, there have been a number of organizations that have endured simply to live in the presence of a quietude, the quietists. We find them coming to this country, the pietists, the Mennonites, all of these people searching for peace, searching for a way of living together in brotherly love in a world of discords. Today, the facts are getting very strenuous and very obvious. We can no longer do it this way. If we do, our problems will get worse, and we will have more to fear and very little evidence of faith. But unless we make change, correct our own mistakes, and start doing it right, the fact that we are not going to be able to be happy without being right is the final proof of faith. It proves to us conclusively that we have got to live the life if we would know the doctrine. And this is what we all have to have. I just noticed a few days ago in the paper that one of the American missionary societies has made an unusually liberal statement, for which they should be congratulated. They point out that while they are working to convert various people to Christianity, that in this country now, with its complete admixture of practically every faith known to man, all religions must be treated with full respect. This is, I think, a very important statement. It shows a break in what was otherwise, for a long time, a pretty closed corporation. But it's coming. We are going to find the final joy of life in this recognition that there are no real reasons for the miseries that we are nursing. We can, with a little integrity, have employment for everyone who needs it. We can have all of the justice that we want if, as individuals, we will earn it. Now, we may have trouble in trying to earn it because we will have to go against a common stream that is flowing in the opposite direction. We probably can't accomplish it all at the moment, but we can certainly clear the inside of our own cup. We can see that in our families, among our friends, and in everything that we are in contact with, we do it as well as we know. Not because it is a satisfaction to ourselves, but that the honesty of our own conduct is our living prayer to the power at the root of life. We pray by keeping the rules. And if we keep the rules will keep us. And if we have faith that by keeping the rules they will keep us, then we are deeply religious people, regardless of the sect or creed we belong to. Because there is no worthwhile religion anywhere in the world that doesn't teach this very same thing. That everything depends upon the person who wants to become better or to know more, to earn the right to possess more knowledge and insight. Wisdom is the one thing we can all possess without depriving anyone else of anything. The values that we are striving for do not interfere with the rights of other people to grow or to live better. We may trouble them if we take their goods, but we can learn to live the ideals of life without impoverishing anyone or detracting from the well-being of anyone. And the mysticism is important now because we have a great deal of emphasis upon psychic phenomena at the present time. There are many people who, under the pressure of present conditions, are in becoming involved in various types of psychological psychism, most of which is frustration, at least in many cases. But in this particular phase of the matter, we have to realize that until the individual puts his life in order, he cannot depend upon his psychic experiences. His psychic experiences can arise simply from the subconscious part of himself and can justify anything he wants them to justify. The only way in which a psychic experience is meaningful is if it justifies a reality that is already established. If it proves beyond question that doing it better means that the individual has better insights, this is proper. But we must realize that the individual's mind and emotions and habits and practices must be refined and regenerated, or he cannot depend upon any psychic experiences from within himself. They are not a substitute for integrity. They cannot fulfill their promise unless the total person is worthy of that fulfillment. And where the psychic experience becomes an hypnotic factor in living, the individual is always doomed to disappointment. Therefore, faith is only valid to the degree that it is earned by conduct. We can have faith in that which we inwardly understand. But when we get through with the falseness of things and get down to the point where our faith is real and natural, it is simply a realization that we all have, that we inwardly have proven to our own internal insights and consciousness that all is in the heavens and right with the world, that we are in the presence of an infinite good which we can love, and in the presence of a finite mass of mistakes which we can learn not to love, but to gradually redeem, reform, and revise in our own thinking. In these ways, we can go into the people and into the ideals and dreams and purposes that we want to accomplish. So faith is something we can all have. You don't even have to know how to read and write. Faith is the belief that there is something good that is indestructible, and that that something good cannot be destroyed by the evils of men. They can, however, destroy themselves trying to destroy it. And in the end, we have other rules that also must take over. The problem of faith also finds a great deal of justification in the concept of rebirth, because this concept helps to justify integrities. It helps us to realize that we are paying old debts, which we probably declared invalid long ago, but never met. We are also building toward a future in which the dreams that we have can come true. It's even if, as the Greek philosopher who was lying in the little back room of his house on his deathbed, and the family was gathered in the front room, whispering and talking and passing on scandals, waiting for the old gentleman to die. One of the family suddenly turned around and looked into the other room and saw the old man had sat up in bed with his hand clasped behind his ear, listening intently. And the relative said, "Why are you listening? You're not going to be here long. What does all this gossip mean to you?" He said, "I may not be living long, but as long as I live, I can learn." And this, he figured he might learn something that he could use in some other embodiment, because like most Platonists, that was his belief. So we all can say maybe that we don't come into some of these integrities until what it seems to be too late. But it is never too late. The individual can grow on his deathbed and can become a greater person as long as he has a moment of life left in him. And then when he goes out, the greater life that he has takes over, and he becomes that which he has attained in understanding and insight. And the growth process, the factor of constant improvement, carries on from one life to another, building up the infinite perfection at the end of life in existence. Now, after we fulfill everything that we are supposed to fulfill as human beings, it doesn't necessarily follow that we go off to some mysterious heaven where we remain the rest of eternity. We go to something else. When we have outgrown and graduated and got our BA in the University of Hard Knocks, we then go on and get our master's after death. And we finally get our doctorate after we have become universal servants of humanity. when we've got the job and are doing it. Then we mature cum laude. Until then, we're all learning, but even as we learn, we work. We are doing something even while we're in school. Everything has to have reason and purpose. The school needs vision terribly at this time. It needs to know that it should prepare young people to live, that it should help them to have a vision of faith instead of being gradually corrupted into hopeless infirmity of spirit. All of these things we have to do, and I think that there perhaps is better evidence now that we're beginning to realize this than there has been for a long time. In the Protestant Reformation in Germany, there came forth a great mysticism. The individuals of that time did get together and build their utopias, resolved that they were going to improve things. They took away the boundaries of aristocracy and theology and opened the way for the rise of science, the improvement of education, the improvement of social conditions. André in Germany founded the first labor unions back in the 17th century. All of these things were progress. They opened a new world. And in order to plan this a little more effectively, suddenly there was a new continent, a continent unspoiled by the wars, strifes, and conspiracies of Europe. In this new continent, men could build a better way of life than they had ever known. They could find freedom. They could worship God according to the dictates of conscience. They could also live in simple brotherhood as against the tremendous pressures of European politics. It was a wonderful dream. It was a beautiful dream. And it started very, very well, because it was always the search for a greater opportunity for integrities. But the great enemy of integrities is prosperity. As soon as the country began to flourish, it became possible for one to profit off of another. This occurred. It was also terrible to witness the tyranny of religion that arose in this land which we had come to in order to find peace and tranquility and the right to worship God. We suddenly discovered that it had no relationship to location at all. The new continent did not do what it was hoped, because the people that came here were of their old prejudices, their own old conceits, and their old conspiracies into this world. The new world was damaged by those who could not be new people, but were putting their old wine in a new bottle, but it still was the same wine. So these people were unable to fulfill the dream of this country. Gradually, we passed through, in maybe 300 or 400 years, more than the rest of the world had passed through in 10,000 years. We became a great and powerful nation. We began to develop all kinds of problems that should have been solved but were not. We were afraid that solution would interfere with gain or with political advantage. Little by little, we lost the dream. But now, in this last emergency, the dream is coming back. All over the world, people are again searching for the integrities and the idealisms that must come. Perhaps we are starting because of fear. But if we are starting because of fear, it is because of ignorance, which, of course, is the reason for the trouble in the first place. But out of this fear, we also have a sense that if we can save it, if we can prevent the situation from becoming impossible, that there is possibility still that in this world there will ultimately be the brotherhood of humanity, that we will work together for those ends which are right. But to do this, cooperation must take the place of competition. Brotherhood and friendship must take the place of selfishness and suspicion. We must live the principles. And the only way that we can get the strength to live principles today is through faith. We cannot have this faith because we understand everything. But we have to have this faith by realizing that there is an infinite good whether we understand it or not. And if we keep the rules will keep us. That there are laws and principles that are eternally right in the very structure of the cosmos itself. That all universal processes reveal infinite law. All the great combinations of elements and patterns show a wisdom beyond comprehension. A faith in these visible evidences of an invisible inevitable will help us and guide us in the various problems that we face every day. We know from the smallest to the greatest the tremendous eternity and eternality of existence. We realize that there has to be something tremendous, it's all sufficient, behind these various phenomena which we now notice. Otherwise, the whole problem is a ghastly travesty. But the travesty is not built upon absolute certainties. Some kind of a falseness is not built upon absolute mathematics. The universe mathematically is perfect, according to Pythagoras. We know now that biologically and psychologically, it is infinitely suitable to the needs for which it was fashioned. Therefore, we can no longer say that we are living in a universe that hasn't any sense. What we must try to realize is that we are limited in our own understanding, but that belief in infinite good, belief in the ultimate fulfillment of all that is best, the realization that progress goes on and can go on until all living things become fully aware and awake to the great realities of existence. With these types of thoughts, we can have a little faith, we can do a little better, we can hold back a few unkind words, we can wish someone well whom we haven't spoken to for 20 years, we can forget the feuds of families, we can overcome the mistakes of our children, we can stop looking for gratitude and rather look for truth. We are all emotionally involved, selfishly and self-centeredly, but beyond all this, there must be the tremendous dedication to that which is necessary for the fulfillment of the plan of existence. If we recognize that plan as real, that is the beginning of a great faith. And if from this faith we build a greater understanding of the processes involved, this is the beginning of a great factual relationship with existence. These are the things we have to think about. These are the things that are coming in. And the fact that we're here this morning to talk about these things indicates that more and more people are concerned, and that from this common concern, we are going to gradually correct the mistakes that have been made. We're going to rise above the criminals and delinquencies that we have been afflicted with in recent years. There is a solution, and that solution is in nature's keeping. Nature is not going to destroy us. It has never destroyed anything. But it is going to gently and kindly lead us in the way we should go. And if we refuse to travel in that direction, we may have a small punishment bestowed at a proper time and in an appropriate place. Realizing, therefore, that we are part of an eternal project, that we are something that's going to outlast all the banks and business loan companies, that we are going to go on beyond the last fort and the last gun, we are going to go beyond all of the conditions of now, and we are going to gradually outgrow the smallness in ourselves. And in so doing, we will gradually overcome the smallness in the world. These are the things I think we have to think about if we want to live well in these very confusing and unsettled times. Thank you very much.